She's been on the front lines in the fight for public education for decades, and in her new book, Slaying Goliath, she shares the stories of the resistance and their successes. Diane Ravitch is here to bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From Newsweek.com, Virginia School Board votes 7-1 against banning Confederate flag from dress code. Board's only black member dissented.
Well, there it is. So, majority wins. Right?
I guess so.
It's not a racist symbol because the majority of white people said it's not.
So exactly.
So that's how we do. That's democratic. That's a democracy. That's a vote one in favor of the majority wins. Or as we dig deep into this, there's a history here, and you and I were talking about this, Bonnie.
Right.
And you're sitting there going like, okay,
this is a tough one for
growing up in the late 70s. Bo and Luke Duke and the General Lee.
I did not see that as any sort of racist symbol. Those were my good old boys driving around the General Lee.
Right, they were just good old boys.
And that was a symbol on top of their car that just meant they were from the South, and that's what they were proud of.
And I said, I think this one, though, as you point that out, is the early 70s to now 2020, and the history of the symbol of the Confederate flag itself is one of those things that is actually being debated here in one way or another, because I made the comment that in the 80s, Billy Idol and Rebel Yell had a rebel flag draped around him. No one came out and claimed Billy Idol to be a racist for wearing that, right?
Right.
You know? But as times have moved forward now, the understanding of that flag and how it's used and how we've seen people intentionally put it in front of others to create discomfort. Now, that's different than the 70s Bo and Luke Duke and Billy Idol raising his fist with his snarled lip yelling Rebel Yell.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So is that what this one board member, the one African-American who voted to say we should ban the Confederate flag in schools, was talking about the fact that today, 2020, when we see that in a school, that might be a racist, intimidating symbol? Or is this, as the article then goes in to say, is this a free speech issue?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What I mean,
That's where I get torn on the whole thing. When I read this first, I'm like, well, it's free speech.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I understand the symbolism behind the flag now. I get that. Because I have that kind of attitude when I see it too, of now, of ooh.
Yeah, well, you know, somebody's trying to make a statement now.
I see it, because it is more of a statement than it is a symbol of how what you believe
I'm
anymore.
Just a good old boy rebel.
Right, exactly.
Doesn't mean that anymore. It's kind of F you, I'll put you in your place.
Right.
Black and brown person.
Right, exactly. And if you look at the, you know, the school board was 7-1 Caucasian to African American. That seems to be what this whole district is too, because Franklin County, where this is happening, 87% Caucasian and 8% African American.
Right.
So, you know, we can look at a symbol in central Wisconsin and think it means one thing, and you live there and it could mean totally different, and their sentiments are different.
So on this, though, we're going to have to look at this. This is an emerging story. It's one school board. But again, place matters. History matters.
Yeah.
From a Busted Pencils point of view, though, I'm going to go with the lone African-American vote and say this is a racist symbol.
From TheGuardian.com, schools are killing curiosity. Why we need to stop telling children to shut up and learn. Young children sit cross-legged on the mat as their teacher prepares to teach them about the weather, equipped with pictures of clouds. Outside the classroom, lightning forks across a dark sky and thunder rumbles. Curious children call out and point, but the teacher draws their attention back. That's not how the lesson target says they are going to learn about the weather.
Of course not. Why would you ever think you're going to learn about weather
by
watching
looking the weather?
You've got a perfectly good textbook.
Here's the picture. Don't look outside, kids. Here's a cloud.
And handouts in front of you. These children need to be pulled back into the conditioned classroom to pay attention. This is...
That first paragraph, I was like, are you kidding me?
and I think it's not necessarily drawn from a real experience, but to say that I've seen this happen multiple times in classrooms, yes, it happens all the time. Stop that. come back, pay attention, we're learning here.
Right.
As if the curiosity about what's going on is not learning.
Right.
Okay. You got to understand, learning occurs in front of a book at your desk, paying attention to me, teacher. It doesn't occur when you're asking questions about issues here. This is a great article, and it really has a lot to do, particularly with early childhood and especially when we look at going, these kids ask tons of questions, right? And people, in one way, used to say, well, we need them to pay attention so they can learn. And the reality is that actually we need to encourage those questions and not encourage compliance sitting there and learning, because compliance sitting there paying attention and learning does not create the best experience for kids in their long-term future. So little kids, when they ask a question, Bonnie, let them ask a question. The other part, though, that's really cool about this research from The Guardian, though, is that when we talk about this, the benefits on students from lower socioeconomic areas is that this idea of encouraging questioning seems to be one of those things, the, quote, achievement gap that we're always trying to go after. This is one of the ways that you actually bust the achievement gap, encouraging curiosity. Asking questions, asking little kids to ask questions. So there's a benefit for everybody, but it seems that even those at the bottom of the achievement gap, the earlier we get to them, the more we let them ask questions, the better off we're all going to be.
From Time.com, the education reform movement that has failed America. We need common sense solutions that work.
We do. I agree. Yeah. Article written by Dr. Diane Ravitch, mm-hmm. who, just to put it out there, is going to be the main guest coming up right after this news segment.
Okay.
So I want to put this, you read her piece in Time.
She's
got a new book coming out, or it's already out. And we spend a lot of time talking about this in the interview. But what do you think about her piece in Time? Has Bush, Obama, Trump failed American public schools?
Yes, the way this is laid out, when I read this article, it seemed like here's a pile of garbage we're going to start with.
Right.
And then, oh, I'm going to make a bigger pile of garbage. And oh, wait, I can do one better.
Right.
It just seems like it just kept piling on with bad ideas.
So why? Why does that happen? I mean, and this is Democrats and Republicans, right?
It's everything.
Equal shared blame for destroying, hurting, harming, putting forth ideas, as you said, garbage piles, right?
Yeah.
Adding to those garbage piles, things that just don't make sense.
Right.
That actually created a system now 20 years since No Child Left Behind that scores, as Dr. Ravitch points out, are no better than they were beforehand. In fact, at some of the bottom scores are dropping. Scores on international tests have not gone up. And remember, all of this was put forth from the idea that we're not doing well on tests.
So give more tests.
So this whole movement to, and I love the way she reclaims the name reform and says reform is a positive. These people are not reformers. They're disruptors.
Yes.
What do you think about
it? That was a very interesting take on my part, because I think people sit in seats of power sometimes and they said, I'm going to make this change and we're going to reform this and we're going to reform that. And they see it as something that they can put their stamp on instead of being actually in the business of it. And she's right. They're just disrupting what's happening to everybody, and it's making a bigger pile of garbage.
So the disruptors, the thing is they just keep going. And so I've always talked about this. There's an insanity here, particularly when you said people in power, politicians, she points out billionaires. The combination of billionaires and politicians over 20-some years trying to reform or actually disrupt American public education, they've been wonderful at doing that, let's be honest. So they can claim victory to disrupting the entire American public school system over the past 20 some years, to the point that we still have an incredibly large achievement gap. Teachers can't stay in the classrooms longer than 3 to 5 years. They're running away, right? And so they've really disrupted. How do you bring this back, though, is with a resistance. And you're going to meet the resistance when we talk to Dr. Ravitch right after this. She is one of the foremost authorities on education and the history of education in the United States. She was also former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education. She's the author of the best-selling Reign of Error. She's been called a whistleblower extraordinaire by the Wall Street Journal and Fearless by Jonathan Kozol. Her new book, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools, is out. Welcome back to Busted Pencils, Diane Ravitch. Hello, Diane.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to be with you.
Wow. Another book.
Well, this one had to be written. It's absolutely amazing. I think this so, first of all, what they call the reform movement is neither reform nor is it a movement.
No, and, you know, we've talked about this. I mean, I've, you know, been interviewing you since the first, the 2010 book, you know, The Public Schools, where you came out and started, as people said, that was your turning moment. We did that interview, and you've been pointing this out, the DianeRavitch.net, just constantly pointing out the disruptors, which is now the name that I love that you give them in this new book, that have been...
They've been them disruptors because that's what they're best at.
Right. I mean, you know, let's use their... I remember they used to use that word as like, you know, we're going to go in and disrupt things and make things better. But I love the idea of turning it back and saying, yeah, you guys are disruptors. And the fact is that the disruption you caused has been really painful for a lot of people. Is that an overstatement or an understatement?
It's an understatement because... I think they knew from the beginning that what they were doing was cruel and that the teachers would be fired who didn't deserve to be fired. Schools would be closed despite the protest of teachers and students and parents and grandparents. And they have this incredible ability to say, it doesn't matter what other people think, we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, and so the book title, though, Slaying Goliath, I mean, this is the part, you know, because... We've done a lot of pointing out, and I think on this show, people who listen to the show, people who read your blog, I think we have a really good sense of the disruptors, Broad, you know, the Waltons, all of those people. What I really want to talk about in this book, though, is what you do here is say, you know what, though, there's been a resistance. And these...
Absolutely.
And the resistance... We are, and I'll put this in there, and I thank you on page 62 for even mentioning my name in there as one of these resistors. But this book, for me, that's the big takeaway is that to point out there's a large network of people that have been saying, no, you're not going to do this to us.
Well, I think this is very important, first of all, because those of us who've been calling attention to the incredibly destructive manner in which this these billionaires have, in a very high-handed way, gone about crushing schools. They claim that they're doing it for good reason and because schools are failing, so they have to crush them. But they have no better ideas. Their ideas are actually worse. And what I wanted to say above all was two things. First of all, we're fighting back, and to encourage people and give especially teachers a sense of hope for the future that this is not going to go on forever. And secondly, to let them know that they're losers. And I think it's very important to keep saying, okay, you may have succeeded in crushing this school, crushing that district, hurting people, but you're losers. You're losers. And, you know, it's every day I come across something else where I wish I were still writing the book. Because today I was on the train from Washington to New York after speaking there a couple of times, and I came across an article in Education Week that said that philanthropists are turning their attention away from K-12 education because they realize they are not getting results. And I thought, yes, right. Of course they're not getting results. It took them 10 years to figure that one out.
But, you know, even that results thing when they say they're not getting results, and, you know, we talked about this 5 or 6 years ago on one of my shows where But they were gay. I think they were and are still reaping the results. The teacher exodus problem that I've been saying, people are saying it's a shortage, the demoralization, the pain that has been inflicted, the cruelty, you know, I think that was the result they planned to get. I don't think they ever really thought they were going to, quote, help children.
Well, they looked at it in terms of we can raise test scores.
Yeah.
They didn't raise test scores.
Right.
And it's not even a good goal to have, because I've come to understand over the years that raising test scores doesn't benefit everybody. It just means that more kids have been driven to do practice tests and test prep over and over again. And then you end up with, okay, we got some higher scores. So what? That's not what education's about. That's not what it should be about. And their fundamental approach to everything is there should be winners and there should be losers, and we hope there are more winners. But they've promised also to close the achievement gap, which they haven't done.
Yeah.
So they're now, I think, having to come face-to-face with the fact that all the promises they made have not come true, and they have wreaked horrible damage on the teaching profession. They've sent forth very idealistic young people from Teach for America and told them that they alone could close the achievement gap. Well, they haven't done it.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've done is to succeed in telling the world that teachers don't need any preparation. They just need a five-week training course, and that's a lie. So there ought to be some way of letting them know, that's what I'm trying to do in my book, that first of all, you failed and you are losers. And it's very hard for people who are billionaires to be faced with the prospect of being called a loser.
Right.
But they are losers, and that's why I want to get that message across. So that I'll see more stories about how they've decided to focus on other things. So they're pouring more money into early childhood, that's good. They're paying attention to things that happen out of school, that's good. They might want to support the arts, that's good. And in my book, what I say they should do is they should all be lobbyists for higher taxes to pay for better education.
Yeah, that seems to be something that I've not seen many billionaires, and there aren't that many, but I've not seen, other than a few, talk about the fact that we should be taxed more. That never seems to be one of the solutions, such as, you know, let me give you my fair share. Instead, it's, as you said, you know, this vulture philanthropy, where it is, we'll give you some money as long as you bend to our will.
Right. Well, I think it's not only that they haven't called for taxes, they're actively working to have their taxes reduced. And if you look at the Trump tax cut of 2017, he certainly succeeded in giving his teammates, or mm-hmm. whatever they are, peers, a big tax cut. But when you come to the wealthiest family in America, the Waltons, they're actively fighting for lower taxes. They should be fighting to pay their workers a decent living wage. But instead, Walmart, if you were to Google the terms Walmart tax cut, you would come up with a whole bunch of places where they are suing to reduce their property taxes. Here they are worth $150 billion,
mm-hmm.
and that's not enough. I just call that pure greed. They also announced the other day that they're planning to put another $200 million into charter schools. And when people say, well, what's in it for them? What's in it for them is they want to crush the teachers' union.
Right.
That is exactly what's in it. And the teachers' unions, the two of them, are the last two strong unions standing. And they can't stand any unions surviving. So they're after them. And they're after them by spreading more charters, which will be non-union, as Betsy DeVos has $440 million to spend on new charters. And one of the wonderful things that happened just recently was she gave a grant of $46 million to New Hampshire to double the number of charters in that state. And the recently elected Democratic legislature said, we don't want your money, keep it.
Nice. Now, I wish that would have happened here in Wisconsin. In fact, you know, Ms. DeVos and Vice President Pence were just here 2 days ago celebrating School Choice Week here in Wisconsin, and because Milwaukee is the home and the birthplace of school choice. So,
well, what you do have to ask yourself what there is to celebrate in Milwaukee, because it's now one of the lowest performing cities in the country. It has three fully blown sectors. a public sector which is overloaded with the kids that the others don't want, a very disproportionate number of kids with disabilities, and it has the charter sector and the voucher sector, and all three sectors are doing terribly. When you look at NAEP, which compares, I think, about 20 cities, Milwaukee ranges very close to the bottom, and at the very bottom is Detroit, which is overwhelmed with charter schools. So I don't understand. What are they celebrating when they go to Milwaukee?
I don't know. I didn't show up. I wasn't invited either, though. So I'm pretty sure
they didn't want you.
Yeah, I'm sure they didn't want me. I would say I don't think Betsy DeVos will ever be a guest on Busted Pencils. But all right. So all of this, though, it's the resistance. When you look at this ragtag group of people, badass teachers, Jesse Turner, Anthony Cody. United Opt Out. I mean, how did they pull it off?
You know, I think that one of the great things about the resistance is there was no money behind them. These were people who spontaneously said, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And they found one another. It started, I think, as I describe in the book, with United Opt Out. People like yourself and Seresta Smith and others saying we have to encourage people not to take the test. And they reached out and more people joined them, and then there were the badass teachers. And group after group just popped up out of nowhere, but out of constantly being attacked, demoralized, assaulted. And people found each other. Anthony Cody and I started the Network for Public Education back in 2013 because we saw these disparate groups, and they weren't in communication. There may have been some of them in communication, but basically there were people in one side of the state that didn't know there were people on the other side of the state, and we didn't want to become a new organization that was independent of anyone else. We wanted to become a group that got people together, and that was our purpose, and so we were able to develop alliances within states and among groups that are in different states. And you see a group like SOS Arizona, and they were incredibly effective. I mean, this is a group that stood up to the Koch brothers and the DeVos family just last year, where there was a referendum about vouchers. And they, the Koch brothers and DeVos, wanted Arizona's voucher program to expand yet again. It's one of these camel's nose under the tent approaches where they... First, they have it for kids with disabilities, and they have it for children living on Indian reservations, and it goes to the next group and the next. And SOS Arizona didn't raise a lot of money, but they got some. They weren't penniless, but compared to people like the Kochs, who were worth $120 billion, they were less than paupers. And they beat them, and they beat them because they took it to the people.
Right.
And one of the things that I most enjoyed in writing this book was identifying the people who stood up and beat back the Waltons and all of these super wealthy people who are, frankly, this is not important to them. This is just a hobby they have. Whereas it may be for you a profession, it may be for teachers and parents and kids, this is their life. It's not the life of the Waltons. The Waltons have $150 billion.
Right.
If they decide to throw $200 million this year into charters and 200 more next year, it's meaningless. This is that they make $4 million an hour 24/7. So this is like a game for them, as it is for Bill Gates, as it is for all of these billionaires.
You know, and that's the part, I mean, for us, when we did it, like you said, United Opt Out, no money. I mean, we set up that first Occupy, the Department of Education, and then the second one, we were able to get the benefit of you volunteering to come because we had no money to pay speakers. You know, we paid for our hotel rooms and slept together in there and set that all up. Nobody funded us. You know, you look at the movement there with the badass teachers and how that just kind of came together. Yeah, and that's what I appreciate you pointing that out. It had to be, though, like exciting as you started chronicling all of these resistors, because there I learned about more when I read the book, ones that I didn't know.
Right. Well, they're all these wonderful stories, and I've been saving them. I didn't know what I was saving them for, but I just looked back through trying hopelessly to clean my computer, and I found it in 2015. I had a file called Victories, And that was, well, almost 5 years ago. So little by little, we've been pushing back. And I think that where people become most effective is when they discover they're not alone.
Yes.
And it's very important to have a sense that there are others on your side, that they'll back you, that it doesn't, of course, it would be nice to have money, but it's not necessary. And what I've discovered in working on this book and just in daily life is there are people out there who are literally all alone, and yet they keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And someday I think that it's going to be, they will turn the tide, and people will look back and say, why didn't I listen to that guy sooner? I mean, I'm thinking of someone like Ed Johnson in Atlanta. And Ed Johnson, I'm included as a BCC on his emails. He writes to the Atlanta school board with regularity, telling them why this approach they're taking of trying to become a portfolio district, trying to be like New Orleans is crazy and it's not going to lead to good results, and tries to instruct them about the dimming methods, which are based on collaboration and teamwork and not on winning and losing. The philosophy behind the disruptors is one that's deeply anti-democratic. And someone asked me in one of my recent appearances, they said, why are these disruptors so opposed to democracy? And I said, that's their greatest fear. They really are afraid that if the people get the vote, they're going to be out of, they're going to be thrown out. And they, and this is what happens again and again. And it's also the case that, you know, when you're up against big money, they will flood elections with money. But I think one of my favorite stories in the book is the story of Massachusetts, where they flooded Massachusetts with money, and the teachers, of course, couldn't match them. But between the teachers and the parents and the local school boards, they worked very hard together and had a ground game. The Waltons never had a ground game. Right. What they had was millions and millions of dollars, and they lost. The teachers and parents and local school committees won, and they basically just defeated the whole plan.
Well, democracy won in that instance, like you said, and so it's still our hope. When I for me, the book comes at such a great time because there are days where you sit down and go, you know what, I don't know if I can do this anymore. I don't know, even just the job of being a dean in teacher education, you know, as I'm watching students not want to become teachers, as I look at the things that constantly seem to keep coming at me, it's like, you know, I need to take a break. I need to stop this. I need to find something else to do. But then you come along with your new book and say, no, Tim, we're winning.
Yep, I think we are. I mean, it's frightening in a way to realize that all the things you've been working on, you're actually winning, because there are days when it doesn't feel like it. When you read that the Waltons are pouring another $200 million into charters, when you read that the Republicans in Congress gave Betsy DeVos another $440 million, it's very disheartening. And then when you read that New Hampshire said, no, we don't want your money, take it back, I mean, that's amazing.
Right.
And one of the things the Network for Public Education has done has been that we have had, I think, a pretty incredible output of reports. One of the reports was about the waste in the federal charter schools program.
Yes.
It started out as back in 1994 with the idea there weren't very many charters, and the federal government should lend a hand to startups, lend a hand to these mom-and-pop charters that needed a couple of million dollars to get off the ground, maybe a couple hundred thousand. It's turned into Betsy DeVos's slush fund for the big corporate charter chains.
Right. I've had, and in fact, yeah, that you know, I've had Carol on to talk about that report, because it's just the corruption that's so rampant there, that this idea that we're, quote, making better schools, when actually they're closing, people are getting money. Some of the schools aren't even opening, and yet the money is still being allocated. And so the Network for Public Education, like you say, putting that out there, all of this. The other thing, though, to come back, it's not over, though, is it?
Oh, no, and a number of people have said, are you saying that we won? No, we haven't won, but we're winning. The fact is, everything they've done, and I can say this without a qualification, everything that the so-called reformers have done has failed, and yet they keep pouring more money into it. They keep pushing more organizations. I think that it's maybe once a month, maybe more often, a new organization will be announced, and they'll say, well, now we have Brightbeam. And Brightbeam is supported by Education Post and a couple of other different organizations the billionaires have created. Earlier this year, it was the City Fund. And the City Fund, it's all these recycled people who failed somewhere else, someone from New Orleans, someone from Memphis, someone from this charter chain. It seems that if you're part of this movement, you will be taken care of forever. There'll always be a job for you. The Hoover Institution just sent out a notice that I got today as I was on the train that they're creating a new initiative run by Eric Hanushek and also Chris Ruskowski. And I just remembered Chris Ruskowski was the last school superintendent in New Mexico. He was preceded by Hannah Scandera, who had also been from the Hoover Institution. And they had 8 years in which to fix the problems with their Jeb Bush ideas. And New Mexico didn't change one iota on NAEP. They have one of the biggest poverty problems in the country, which they did nothing to address. They just tried to adopt the Florida model, which is grade and test and accountability and teacher evaluation. So Rick Hanushek and Ruskowski are starting a new plan to push the idea that teachers have to be evaluated by test scores. Mm. And I thought, wait a minute, when have we heard that song
before? They were recycling that again,
yeah.
Right?
we already did that. It didn't work. It failed. So they're doing it again. So they've not only have had no success, they're recycling their failures.
Well, so we still, you said, you know, we still have a lot to do. The book is Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. It's Diane Ravitch's new book. Diane, I typically say at the end of the show, thanks for busting pencils, but thank you for helping all of us engage in this fight, take down Goliath.
Well, Goliath is still there, still right. Pushing. Still throwing his slings and arrows. But I want to do two things with this book. Number one is to give hope and courage to all those who continue fighting, to have real schools, and not the same schools we have, but far better schools mm-hmm. than the ones we have, far better resource than the ones we have, but also to send a message to the Goliaths of the world that no matter how much money they have, they've run out of ideas, and they're brain dead, and they're losers.
And they're losers. Well, on that, that is a busting pencils. Diane Ravitch, thank you so much for your time today. Always a pleasure to have you on Busted Pencils.
Thank you, Tim, and keep fighting.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zen.
A good education is a synthesis of book learning and involvement in social action because each enrich the other. The accumulation of knowledge, while fascinating in itself, is not sufficient without action.
My thanks to legendary education historian and activist Diane Ravitch. Be sure and check out her new book, Slaying Goliath. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Remember to share, rate, and subscribe to our podcast. And keep busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.